positive, actually.
Yeah.
All right, my name is Chris Bell, and today's date is the 21st of April, 1983. And I'm at the home of Air Marshal Dunlap, excuse me, with cold. And this is the fourth interview we're doing on the subject of social life in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And we've dealt with the subject, I think, fairly thoroughly in the previous three interviews. We're going to tie up some loose ends, if any such ends exist. And perhaps I should ask you, Air Marshal, if there's anything you would you've thought of in the past while that you'd like to add to what we talked about earlier.
Well, I must confess I haven't been doing very much thinking in the past while. I've been involved in so many other things. So I think I better let you go ahead, and if anything comes up as we're talking, I'll throw it in.
Okay. One thing we didn't talk about, though I imagine we mentioned it briefly in passing, was your uniform. You were required to be kitted out in a particular fashion. You had to have mess kit, you had to have what?
All right, well, there were some unusual aspects to the uniform which have long since been forgotten. But let me first of all mention the uniforms that we were required to have, and then I'll refer to the special features. One, of course, the uniform was the blue Barathea, similar to the Royal Air Force uniform. The material was the same. It was that steel blue, I guess you would call it, uniform. And that was number one service dress. There was also a summer kit, which was a khaki drill, shorts if you were in a hot climate like Camp Borden, or longs if you were in other parts of Canada where you had less
warm weather.
Less warm weather and more insects. The dress uniform, well, mess dress, was the mess kit, the gold stripe down the trouser leg, gold insignia rings on the sleeves, and of course gold wings if you were an air crew, and a little sort of pea jacket cut from the V back and so on. And of course, later on in the mid-30s, added to those requirements, one had to have full dress uniform. Now, it wasn't until, I guess it wasn't about 1935 that requirement was issued. And the various members of the force were given a span of time within which to acquire. And I think that span of time was from 35 to 38, something like that.
What was the reason for this?
And, well,
because it was during the Depression when money was somewhat scarce.
Yes, but it was, there was no consideration of Depression because it was time that the Air Force reached the stage of having dress equivalent to the other services.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy had full dress and had for a long time, and the Army had too. And the Air Force, being so young, it hadn't felt the need of this requirement. But, and I guess it depended a little bit on certain individuals. At that time we had, as the director of personnel at Air Force headquarters, an officer who was very dress conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose he influenced, he set the policy. He decided that the time had come when we should wear the have a full dress uniform to wear. That uniform, I guess the best way to describe it was that the tunic was sort of a maternity jacket. No, that's not a good description. That was a term that was used in reference to it, but the maternity jacket doesn't suggest a close-fitting garment. And it was a very close-fitting jacket. It was tailored right to your skin, really.
Mm-hmm.
And but it did have that front that buttoned right across, instead of having the front that parted buttoned right across, and it was like a little bit like the RFC uniform in World War I.
Why did they adopt that pattern?
And, well, I can't answer that. Then it had the it had a high collar, which buttoned, not buttoned, it had those great big metal fasteners that throttled you in the neck. And when and that collar, depended on your rank, of course, as you increased in rank, there were more and more gold filigree around the collar. And it meant that the collar was a very expensive thing. And the collar was a very tight thing. And it was not expandable. Once you put this decoration on it, you couldn't expand it in any way. Well, as a matter of fact, you couldn't expand it even without the decoration. So that you were for it. And I was a fairly young lad when when I bought my first full dress uniform. It was in my mid to upper 20s. And that's a period of time, and sometimes you do put on a little bit of weight. And I had I made my purchase of full dress uniform in 1935, and I didn't have any occasion to use it for the first 2 years of its life. And when I went back to that, and of course, at that time you couldn't get it in Canada. You got it when you happened to be in the UK. And you waited you were in the UK because it had to be so carefully tailored and fitted. It meant, if you were fussy about fit, it meant at least a half dozen fittings of the tailor.
With a full dress uniform, you want it to look
good. Oh, yeah, it had to fit. There's no question about that. So when I went back to the UK in 1937, and I was over there on a two-year assignment in 37 to 39, that first uniform was so tight around the neck that it was uncomfortable. I had just expanded enough. I suppose instead of having a size 15 neck, I had become a 15 and a half, or I'd gone up only about a half size, but that made the difference. So I decided, well, these are damn expensive things, too. I decided that I would get another one, and that when I got back to Canada, it would be easy to dispose of the first one because I was more or less an average size and build. So, funny part was, I of course wore that tight necked one once in the UK in, I guess, 1937, because I went to St. James's Palace to Levee on New Year's Day. And I wore it once at Buckingham Palace, that's right, later on in that period. So by the time I got the second one made, and it was made, I was on the point of being promoted as squadron leader, so I said to the tailor, well, you may as well make it up with squadron leader insignia on it, because that gold braid on the sleeve was a damn expensive thing, and to change from one rank to another, you had to change the whole damn thing because you couldn't have a discolored ring on and a bright one. You had to have all one thing. So I said, make it up in squadron leader. And if I have to wear it before I'm promoted, I'll put up with the tight neck and wear the other one. Well, you know, when I came back to Canada in spring of 1939, I had these two full dress uniforms. And what should happen? Within weeks of my return, I was assigned to, it was the year that the King and Queen, King George the Sixth and Queen Elizabeth came to Canada. I was detailed to for guard duty at the entrance to Rideau Hall. And they were in residence for 4.5 days. And I was on duty for 4.5 days. And I had to wear that tight neck thing the whole time. Here I was with a brand new, well-tailored, well-fitting thing that I hadn't quite been promoted to squadron leader. So I had to suffer that for that period of time. So, and then, of course, when the war came, there was no further requirement for full dress. You forget about things like that when there's a war on. You put them away. And when and the war ended, everybody forgot about photographs, and it was decided that we would not make it a requirement that people would have to. These things had become damn expensive in the interval, and gold had become very expensive. So that was put away. Well, now, that uniform, I hadn't finished describing it. It had a headgear that was sort of looked like a half football, you know, leather, black leather on top, and then had fur pattern, close-clipped fur all around the sides, and it had a plume up the thing up the top. And of course, by way of extra ornamentation, you had a sword belt and sword. And that sword that's hanging out there in the entrance hall is the sword that went. Incidentally, that's the King George V sword out there, because he was the monarch when I got my first full dress uniform. So I got the sword, but the first one, not the temptor, carried on with the. Well, I guess he died in 1935, just at the time I got that sword. So that was the full dress uniform. Yeah.
I'm quite intrigued by the headdress. Do you have a photograph of yourself in it? Because it does sound rather different.
Yes, I have, I'm sorry, but it's on slide, so I can't very well readily produce it for you. But
sounds unique.
I've got a slide of my grandson wearing the flight lieutenant jacket. Full dress jacket, and his pal was visiting him from Kingston wearing the squad leader jacket, and they one of them had the helmet on, and they would alternate these two or three pictures. You see the helmet going from one to the other as they posed in it. Just a minute. I've got a picture just in the next room. Things have a habit of getting moved around in this household.
I appreciate you looking for it.
There. There's the Busby, as it was called. He has a little insignia, Air Force insignia on the front there. And that, I can't remember what that fur was.
Beaver.
But it was close clipped. It was something like a close clipped beaver, but I don't think it was beaver. And that was a gold braid band around it, but that's gold and blue. And this was a bluish gray plume. There's the sword belt there, and the sword. All of those things are damn expensive. And the sword itself in those days was only about $100, but nowadays, they're expensive. And of course, the sword and all those things add up to the overall cost. That picture there was taken the night we went to Buckingham Palace. Now, you see, being very junior in rank, I only had one gold oak leaf on the collar.
Mm-hmm.
But as you got each promotion, you added to them, and they got sort of right around the collar. But you notice there was a gold band top and bottom of the collar,
mm-hmm.
and front too. So there was no way you could expand that if it got tight. You had it. And it had epaulets there.
How did the uniform compare to the RAF dress? You say it was the same.
It was identical.
Was it?
And the only difference was that the buttons were an RCAF button, and the wings were an RCAF wing. I don't think you could find any other dissimilarity in the two.
Including the headdress? The
headdress was identical.
Right.
And the badge was identical. Of course, and that's in keeping with the fact that our regular service dress was identical with the RAF, except for the buttons and the wings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was going to tell you about some of the peculiarities. Service dress came in two forms. One of which was with slacks, and that was the one that was worn ordinarily.
Mm-hmm.
But the other form was with breeches. And there was quite a smart design of breeches. Like, they were sort of like riding breeches, but they were in the blue, of course, of the leather facing on the inside of the legs. And you wore with those puttees if you were a junior officer and field boots if you were a senior officer. And the dividing line was at the rank of squadron leader. Squadron leader and above wore black boots that came up almost to the knee. Quite smart looking they were. And squadron leader in those days was a senior officer. Not so much anymore, but since they were, the Air Force was so small, there were so few senior ranks that a major, which was the equivalent of squadron leader, that rank level was quite senior. And indeed, when I joined the Air Force, there was only one other rank more senior to squadron leader, and that was wing commander. Mm-hmm. And he was the head of the whole outfit. And also the base commander, Camp Borden, carried that rank too. Wing commander Croyle was the commander when I went there, and he was fairly senior. Now, the other, of course, those putties that we had to wear, they had to be very, there was a prescribed method of winding the putty around your leg, and you had to start the seam just in the right place, and you had to end with the there was sort of a V shape at the end. Mm-hmm. There was a flat cut off at the bottom and a V shape at the end, and that V and its lashings that went around had to be right there on the right-hand side, the outer side of each leg, and at the midpoint of the leg. It couldn't be an inch one way or the other. Well, when you start off with a putty that's about 20 feet in length, it's not too... It takes a little bit of doing to get to know just the right tension to make it. And that depends on the size of your leg, too, and your own shape and form.
You can't start from the top of the right place.
No. And that was an aggravating business. It was all right if you weren't in a hurry or you weren't tense. You generally always came up in the right place. Mm-hmm. You could sort of anticipate as you're getting up near the top and vary the tension on it. It was a fairly stretchy swap. But I remember once when we were attending the coronation of George the Sixth, I guess it was. Yeah, coronation of George the Sixth, and I had to appear in the dress for spectators and one thing or another. For people who were closely involved with the ceremony, it would have been full dress, but. But for those who were officially there in the viewing stands, the dress was breeches and putties. Mm-hmm. And of course, for a ceremony like that, where there are hundreds of thousands of spectators descending on the route, I suppose I could have said millions, and it wouldn't be an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. You had to get maneuvered into your position early, otherwise you might never get there. You're fortunate enough to have an assigned seat in the stands, which of course you paid some consideration for. You wanted to make sure of getting there. You had to leave very early in the morning. I remember getting dressed about perhaps 4:45 in the morning in my hotel in London. You had to get up there the day before. You'd never get into the city. They never get into London by motor car on the day in question. You had to get up the night before, so I was staying in the hotel. And I remember in the early hours in the morning trying to get that damn thing to stop in the right place, and it just wouldn't. Which, of course, is one of the things that happened with ornery things like that. Well, now that, okay, we're talking about that form. That was a variation on the number one service dress. incidentally, one also had... No, I guess I'm not sure on this. I was going to say one also had khaki putties for the to use when you're wearing shorts in summer kit. And I guess I think it was optional whether you had khaki putties or khaki, long khaki socks. I believe the socks were more common. I can't remember that detail. But the other thing that I was going to tell you about, which seems unusual. Oh, yeah, before I leave that matter of the putties, there was another feature that was incongruous. Those who wore field boots wore spurs with them. Now, that was a carryover from the fact that the Air Force was an outgrowth of the Army to some extent and of the Navy to some extent, and took portions of the dress from each of those their predecessors. So the spurs were, imagine spurs in an aircraft. Not that you would ever use them in an aircraft, but imagine spurs on an airman, I guess is what I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate. So the other feature that was unusual about that service dress was the fact that one carried a cane with it.
At all times?
At all times. It was a light-colored, almost a natural wood coloring, a highly polished cane, ordinary size and length with a curved handle on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I think I'm right in saying it all times, yes. It wasn't only when you were on parade, but when you were on parade, of course, and the officers were waiting to be invited to fall in, and the troops were forming up, and the officers had to be in orderly fashion. They would be walking back two by two in pairs, not in an organized, regimented fashion, but they would walk along adjacent to the parade square while the troops were forming up, and they would be walking there smartly, swinging their cane. So.
What was the purpose of the cane?
It was just an augmentation dress, you know. It's something to occupy the hands,
mm-hmm.
so that nobody would think of putting a hand in a pocket or anything.
Well, that's what I've heard before, that kept young officers from looking idle.
That's right, yeah. So, there were some of the peculiarities of dress, and that cane was one of them. If we can deviate for just a second, and I know this is nothing of any great value to you, but I can remember one day, I'm telling you because it might amuse you.
Mm-hmm.
We were down at the flight lines, and a fellow officer of mine, contemporary, Brandy Godwin, who later became Airbus Marshal Godwin, was quite a mischievous fellow and quite sharp and quick. Another older friend, who I guess he was World War I pilot, and was a little slow thinking. I'm not associating slow thinking with World War I pilots because they're pretty sharp, but he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was interested in scientific things. And we were having a demonstration from the meteorological officer at the time of the meteorological balloons and the things that they carried into space and the observations that were taken on them and so on. And they used the theodolite to follow the balloon as it went up and determine the wind speeds and directions at various altitudes. And this was a fairly good-sized balloon. I suppose, 3 or 4 feet in diameter when it was inflated. Pretty strong, too. Displaced a fair amount of atmosphere. And I remember Godwin saying to this Charlie Travers, the slightly delightful fellow, but a little slow in thinking. Charlie, I think, knowing that Charlie was interested in scientific things, I think that that balloon would just about lift a walkie stick. And Charlie said, oh, I don't know whether it would or not. Well, Godwin said, well, let's try. And he grabbed Travers' balloon and before you could say Jack Robinson, he had it attached there and released it, and away went this walking stick. Well, of course, precious thing to Travers, and all of a sudden it took him a few moments to realize that he'd been had, and that was his walking stick that was floating up over the top of the hangars. And then when he finally twigged, he started rushing around looking for a stone he could throw at it, you know, to try to bring it down. But of course, by the time he fell off the stone, it was gone. And then his next instinct was, oh, this walking stick, you know, must have cost us, each of us, about $5 a piece. That was a lot of money in those days. The next instinct was to get into an aircraft and get up there and recover it. And by the time we were right there at the hangar line, so by the time he got into an aircraft and got off, of course, he couldn't see the damn thing anymore. So he was the most frustrated. So there's a tail of the stick. Well, the cane disappeared just about from use about that same time, too. So it went up in the air as well. It lasted through, I guess, the mid-30s, but not beyond that.
Was there any use of a swagger stick?
No. I suppose it took the place of a swagger stick in some ways. At times you put this thing under your arm, but normally you carried it as a cane, as a walking cane. Some of those first pictures that I have in albums, the cane shows up very prominently, pictures in uniform. Mm-hmm. I can remember once posing on the float of a moth seaplane in uniform. I think this picture was being taken for my young lady, who is now my wife, and I was standing on a pontoon, leaning against the fuselage with this walking stick in hand, which again was a little incongruous. Just as though I was about to step into the aircraft. Well, there. I think that's about, gives you some idea of the uniforms. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, you had flying kit, which is was a different thing again, but one didn't ordinarily flying uniforms, because in those days, the possibility of oil getting on uniform was very great. Mm-hmm. Because you were flying open cockpit machines, and the engines didn't have an exhaust collector ring the way engines do now. Each cylinder exhausted directly into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Each cylinder had its inlet port and its exhaust port. And all that dirty castor oil was emanating from each cylinder, and it was flowing back along the fuselage, and there was the cockpits were open, and therefore
it had a
little windscreen to keep you from being buffeted in the wind, but that created an eddy, and that eddy caused all this stuff to come down inside the cockpit, and therefore to wear your uniform for any length of time wouldn't get it terribly dirty. So one always wore flying clothing, and there was a winter kit and a summer kit in flying clothing, which gave you protection. You might have your uniform underneath the flying clothing, but very often you took your tunic off at any rate before you geared up.
Mm-hmm. Well, what sort of expense would you have to go to get to be fully kitted out?
Yeah, that's a tax on the memory, but I think that the service dresses, blue and khaki, would be something right around $100.
Quite a hefty sum.
That was a lot of money in those days. The full dress uniforms, of course, were considerably more expensive. Mm-hmm. The mess kit itself was an expensive item. I said the service dresses, khaki and blue, might amount to about $100. I guess the mess kit would, by itself, would also come to a bit more than that, something of that order. And the full dress uniforms would be, when you threw in the sword and all the other trappings, would be $200 or $300, which is a big sum.
But that has to amount to perhaps half a year's pay.
Well, we were getting around $200 a month.
Perhaps a quarter.
Yeah, See, the Air Force got that small extra increment over the other services. We were getting risk pay, fine pay, which amounted to $2 a month. Mm-hmm. $2 a day.
Was it
$2 a day or $1 a day? I've forgotten. It's either $1 or $2 a day. Maybe it was $1. Mm-hmm. So that gave it a little bit more leeway. But of course, the Air Force kind of throw their money around rather recklessly and buy themselves fancy motor cars. So they're perhaps less well off than the Army and the Navy because of that. Yeah. Well, are there any questions about uniforms now after that?
No, I don't think none that I have, because I'm not really a uniform expert. There are some that are. I'm not. I want to get some idea of what you needed to be fully kitted out.
Yeah.
Were parts interchangeable?
There was an interchangeability between the mess dress and the full dress, in that you wore the same trousers.
That's what I thought.
It wasn't, well, now, let me see, I should qualify that. There was just to add to one's gear and expense, there was a mess undress trouser, mm-hmm. which didn't have the gold braid. So for ordinary dining in nights in the mess, you wore that. But the trouser with the gold stripe, broad gold stripe down the side, was interchangeable with full dress.
Mm-hmm. And when would it be a necessity to wear that? During a guest night or?
Yeah, during guest nights or primarily, or let me see, what other occasions would you? During guest nights is when you wear that, yes. But ordinary dining in on the mess, where you weren't
entertaining, I guess.
Where, if you weren't wearing that, you'd be wearing a dinner jacket. No, in some of the messes, they were still quite formal and just ordinary. You dress for dinner almost every night in the week. And, instead of wearing a dinner jacket, as a civilian would, you wore your undress. Undressed, and it didn't have all the gold trappings on. You didn't get dressed up with medals or anything like that. Or miniatures, rather. Miniatures. Incidentally, miniatures are worn with mess dress. Mm-hmm. Medals, full-size, full-scale medals, are worn with full dress.
What would you wear?
And medals, of course, are worn with service blue or on certain parade occasions.
Can I ask you what you would wear to one of the balls you would have?
Yeah. Well, if the ball was of such a nature, for example, if it had a military affiliation or if it had a regal or vice-regal affiliation in some way, you would be wearing the equivalent of tails, mm-hmm. white tie rather than black tie, white vest rather than no best. That's our thing. Mm-hmm. There was a parallel between the civilian dress and the service dress in the mess kit itself for ordinary functions was just a black tie affair, whereas certain special functions it was a white tie affair.
You
always if it's a vice regal function or a regal function, you always wear the white tie. Mm-hmm. And if it were appropriate to do so, you'd wear the full dress. For example, going to Buckingham Palace. Going to Buckingham Palace, or you'd wear the full dress to a social function. I don't know whether that would apply in. I guess it would have on some occasions in Canada, but I just didn't have occasion to wear it. If the life of the full dress was so brief, my history of it was so brief, it just disappeared by the time I would get to the point where I would be involved in social activities like
that. That nature, yeah. You mentioned that when you did buy the initial one, the one with the tight collar, that you wore it so seldom. once or twice, I think you said.
Oh, very seldom. And the second one I bought, I never wore officially. Never.
Yeah.
And I gave those to, both of those to the War Museum in Ottawa before I came out here. Mm-hmm. One of which I never wore. They're both in lovely condition.
Imagine.
Balls hadn't got at them anyway. Very, very heavy gear, you know. The material itself was heavy, the lining was heavy, the interlining was heavy. I suppose they were designed for life in the United Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
where you needed a bit of warmth. But it was a hot uniform to wear. And I wore that at the entrance to Rideau Hall in Ottawa, and it happened to be a heat wave.
Ooh.
It was, although it was in May, I guess it was around mid-May.
Mm-hmm.
You don't very often have a continuous heat wave at that time. But there was about 5 days of hot, sunny weather, and the temperature must have been close to the 90s.
That'd be unbearable.
85 to 90.
And how long would you have been standing out there in any given stretch?
Oh, probably a few hours at a time.
Sunstroke almost.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Was there a tailor that you were sent to? You mentioned that the dress came from the UK.
There, in certain cities in Canada, there were recognized military tailors.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Air Force was fairly localized in its distribution in Canada, you didn't have tailors available all across. You had tailors making Air Force uniforms generally in the centers where there were a fair number of airmen. And that would mean that in Toronto, for example,
mm-hmm.
you'd have a military tailor who also made Air Force uniforms. Beecham and Howe in Toronto made the uniforms for the Camp Borden people.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, his firm was known as Cheatham and Howe. And in Ottawa, the firm of George E. Preston was the tailor for a long time. As time went on and the airmen became a little more numerous, you got other tailors. But, and then there was a tailor in Montreal, I can't remember the name, George E. Preston was recognized as one of the outstanding tailors, and he had the most beautiful cloth.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't think there much like the kind of variation in cloths, but he would go to England, and he would inspect the various manufacturers of cloth before he would place his orders. He would examine their flow of material, and if it suited him, he would order. Mm-hmm. So you always got the right material for charging. That uniform, I could show you a mess kit if you're interested. I don't know if you've ever seen one, but I wore my mess kit when I went down to Winnipeg 2 weeks ago to speak to the at the mess dinner, which was commemorating the 59th anniversary of the formation of the RCAF, and I decided that since there probably would be nothing but green uniforms there, I'd wear my mess kit, my blue mess kit. I found I wasn't alone. I had some others who were in the same gear, but I looked in the pocket, the inner pocket of that uniform, and I noticed that it was made for me in January of 1931, so it was 52 years of age when I wore it last week, 52 years of death.
What about the summer kit? Would that have been...
And that was my second mess kit. The first one I grew out of rather quickly, too.
You were a bit of a mere boy when you joined the force.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I asked about summer kit because General Clark upstairs had mentioned that he had to send away to India for his summer kit.
Oh, he really didn't have to send away to India, I don't think. But I think they had a very good quality and design of summer kit made for the British forces that served out in India. And furthermore, it was rather inexpensive to get it.
He mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah. No, you can get summer kit here at home. And it was good design, but it cost a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's change the subject a bit here. Something that I was rather interested in. We talked some last day about politics and how, at least domestic politics.
Yeah.
And I suppose this would be interesting in that from 37 to 39 you were in the UK, but when the Spanish Civil War broke out or when the Ethiopian conflict broke out, were you guys talking about it? Were you aware that it was going on? And what were you thinking about it?
I can't tell you now what we were thinking about it, but of course one was aware and very conscious of that. We were aware of the fact that signatories to, this is slightly off your question, but signatories to the various disarmament treaties and conferences were breaking those treaties. And we were very conscious of that.
Mainly Japan, Germany, I guess.
And Italy. Mm-hmm. Italy had already launched in 1935 its campaign in North Africa, in Abyssinia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was extremely conscious of that because I was on my honeymoon in the north of Italy in mid-35 during the height of the Abyssinian campaign. And we were in a resort hotel in the Italian Alps, and the highway passed down quite close to the to this hotel, and those military vehicles, Mussolini's, were rumbling down this road to ports of embarkation to go to that part of the world. And of course, we were very conscious of what the Japanese were doing in Manchuria. Say nothing about what the Germans were doing in the way of building up their forces. And these three nations were doing this at the same time. They were making out that they were wholeheartedly devoted to the cause of the United Nations, League of Nations as it was then,
mm-hmm.
and disarmament and so on. And of course, I think I mentioned to you that the purpose of my several months up there in the Queen Charlotte's was associated with the Japanese campaign in Manchuria, in that the Japs had started to move out and involved in this campaign in Manchuria. And we suddenly, in Canada, realized that the Japs were reaching outwards, and there were Japanese naval officers, commanders, and so on, operating fishing boats on our Pacific coast here, surveying our coast and our waters in areas that we really hadn't properly surveyed. So we were, I was personally involved in that, and I knew the Japs in that area who were involved in it, so we were very conscious of what was going on. As for the Spanish War, I can't make a very intelligent comment on how deeply we were concerned about that.
Well,
but I'm sure we were.
Which way would you have felt? Would you, not looking, I guess you wouldn't be taking into consideration the help of the various nations, be it Russia or Germany and Italy, between the two sides in Spain itself. Would you have been sympathetic towards the left or to the right at that time, do you think?
Certainly. We were not sympathetic to the support that Germany gave to the Spaniards, or that the Italians gave the Spaniards. Nor were we happy at all about the Russians getting involved in there. So I would say that the average Air Force officer, myself included, would have been inclined to have taken a fairly neutral. We wouldn't be cheering the cause of the right or the cause of the left. We just didn't like what was going on there. We didn't like this interference from other nations.
Who were using it more or less as a means to fight their own war. Say we had the Mackenzie-Papineau Battalion, I think, fought over there on the side of the left.
Yeah. Oh well. That sort of thing, because they're communists everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Communist activists in this country most Canadians weren't very conscious of them, but they were here and active, and they were there and active. Wherever the communists were involved, the communist sympathizers in other countries were supporting them, so it was understandable you didn't get this sort of thing.
And then we have a leader, was it Buck? Tim Buck?
Oh, Tim Buck, yeah.
Wasn't he leader of the communists at this time?
Yes, he was head of the Communist Party in Canada, and he was a member. No, I was going to say he was a member of Parliament. I guess he was, wasn't it? Rose was a member of Parliament. I forgot whether Tim Buck was or not, but Rose was one of his right-hand chaps, and he was in the House.
He was implicated in the Gruzenko affair, wasn't
he? He was, yeah.
But nonetheless, you were aware of what was going on, and you talked about it.
Oh, yeah.
Would you talk about it in the mess, or would that be considered shock?
No. That sort of thing. You see, we were a fairly... we had to be a fairly studious group because we were confronted with the necessity to write promotion exams and write staff college entrance exams, and there was prescribed reading for all these things. And although this was not prescribed reading, it was very common to find that various officers were on the subscription list of magazines like Foreign Affairs, and which was an excellent way of keeping in touch with what was going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the officers were very conscious of what was taking place politically.
You mentioned promotional exams and staff course examinations.
Yeah, qualifying exams, staff
course.
You couldn't go to staff college, and you couldn't be on the list of candidates for selection of staff college until you passed your staff college entrance exams.
And would this be geared towards you as an Air Force officer, or would it be a general one for all branches?
It would be
of the force?
Pretty general.
Yeah.
Pretty general, although in some aspects of it would naturally be geared towards the Air Force.
And you would choose that particular part of it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, let's try something else. A game you mentioned that you played in the mess, it's still not clear in my mind. Buck-Buck?
Buck-Buck.
Could you play it for me again?
Well, I'll tell you. I'll give you a picture. Yeah.
Okay.
Generally, there was no set number, but generally there would be about eight people on each team.
Mm-hmm.
And one chose some pretty husky fellows for these teams. There was no sense playing Buck-Buck unless you had big, strong, heavy fellows.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd get, it was sort of one team was formed up like an extended scrum in Rugger. If you could think of it, instead of having a sort of a wedge formation such as you have in a scrum, or a solid sort of phalanx such as you have in a scrum, it was elongated,
mm-hmm.
and people were lined up in echelon. The forward fellow had his shoulders against the wall of the room, and each person behind him had his head between the legs of the fellow ahead and locked arms around, so as to make it a pretty tight and solid line.
Mm-hmm.
And then the opposing team would get on the opposite side of the room, charge across, dive through the air, and land on this long line and try to screw it off and collapse it.
Uh-huh.
So that succeeding fellows coming would try to jump higher up on their teammates' backs.
Uh-huh.
So that they could get a bending moment as well as a weighted effect, and try to twist that under team to the point that it collapsed. So it was a very simple, elementary game. It didn't require any great deal of skill. It required a fair amount of strength. A chap who was a good horseman was a good person to have in your team because he could get great pressure in his legs, and he could lean away over and still hold that pressure and try to overbalance the chaps below. And that was...
Was it a popular game?
At mess dinners, yes.
Seems that...